At my sister's wedding, my Uncle Buddy got up to sing. He was a bit of a singer. Well, the pianist played the introduction, deedly-deedly-dee, and Uncle Buddy missed his cue. Again, the pianist played, deedly-deedly-dee, and again, Uncle Buddy missed his entry cue. At the third go, the pianist, somewhat tentatively, played the intro. This time, Uncle Buddy got it right. Where do I begin? To tell the story of how great a love can be. The theme song from the film Love Story. The songs say it all. What's love got to do with it? Everything. Because love changes everything. It seems that all you need is love. It's all about love, old love, new love, and including true love. Love is in the air. Celebrations of love, declarations of love. Which, of course, is why we're here in church Sunday by Sunday. It's all about love, baby. Some folk think it's all about sin, all about judgment, all about gloom and gnashing of teeth, all about an angry God trying to catch us out. So wrong, so wrong. The Bible is a love story. People who don't know it might think it's just a big black book full of rules and regulations, but those who read it and explore its wonderful stories soon come to realise that, in fact, that's what it is, a love story. The account, moving and dangerous and full of poetry and feeling, of God's love for us. Daring images of brides and lovers, of adulteries and betrayals, of love and pain and the whole darn thing. The Bible speaks of a God who cares with a profound caring for each of us. It admits his willingness to be vulnerable. The Bible affirms the centrality to all reality of relationships. Ours with each other, sure, but especially our relationship with him. The Bible, a big, fat, glorious love story. It's always interesting how couples meet. That's one of the questions I like to explore with the couples who come to arrange a wedding. How did they meet? Where did they meet? What peculiar set of circumstances brought them together with such a nuclear fission of liking and loving? I had a funeral on Tuesday of a man of 89. When his wife and I were preparing the service, I asked her how they'd met. It was like a Tom Hanks film. He was Irish, she was American, and they were strangers, standing waiting for a train at Grand Central Station in New York. They got talking, and they were married for 60 years. Well, those still on the hunt for Mr. Right or Miss Perfect, let the record show the modern way is apparently couples meet at bus stops, parties, other people's weddings, work outings, discos and pubs, and nowadays, online. The intriguing set of circumstances that brought Jacob and Rachel together hardly suggested they would hit it off big time. It was all a bit contrived, arranged, brutal, narrowly defined and delimited by race and family and culture. All sort of taken out of their hands in a model we today find strange and rather insulting. But it was how it was then, and we ought not to impose our cultural prejudices and historical perspectives on them. But 14 years, hard labour. Love hurts. Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed to him but a few days because of the love he had for her. But it wasn't just seven, it was seven more. They say when love burns white hot, you never stop to count the cost, but ouch. And of course the hard work still had to come, all the tough-minded, strong-hearted business of making the relationship work, dealing with the crisis points, making sense of the disappointments, adjusting to that other person, coping with teenage children, handling the pressures of sibling rivalry, learning how to grow old together, knowing each other so well, warts and all, and loving through that. Jacob and Rachel were to find out, as all lovers do, that you can't exist in some kind of rosy mist of romance all the time, but that there are mature and courageous decisions that have to be made, and there are all the roller coaster experiences of real life to be dealt with, in the power of love, with the help of love, but no one rendered immune from these experiences just because you're young and in love. Jacob and Rachel is one of the earliest accounts in history, and in the Bible, one of the first expressions of the love between a man and a woman and a man. and its power to mould them into a unity that is stronger than the sum of their two individual personalities. That odd and wonderful, delightful and infuriating experience of being in love and being committed to one another. I tell the couples who come for their marriage preparation class that they, if they found love like that, they've found something very special and tremendous. They've been given a gift that is without price, because you can't make love happen for you. It comes as a gift. You can't go out and decide to fall in love some Tuesday, and you certainly can't ignite that spark of love in someone else by the sheer efforts of willpower. It happens or it doesn't. You find it or you don't. It reaches out and taps you on the shoulder or it doesn't. And once you have it, you've got to take care of it. Let it take root and grow strong and bear fruit. And for that, it needs commitment and exclusiveness. If you want to explore the depths of love, know the richness of it, then you have to give it a context where it will be nurtured and safe, respected, allowed room to breathe, so that before too long, you will realise that love is made of steel as well as gossamer. It has to be adult, able to compromise, willing to lay pride to one side in order to accommodate the needs of the other person. It's an experience that will stretch and test and probe character, for it inevitably involves letting go and letting the other person have some space and power. And because the person who loves us in the intimacy of that special relationship, there is a tremendous vulnerability. When you love, you lead with the heart. You hand over that heart to someone who can break it if they choose. To love is to risk. And yet without that risk, there's no experience of the richness of intimacy and sharing at that deep, special level. And because someone knows us in that special way, love has to be big-hearted and generous, forgiving and patient. Because we are poor, fallen beings capable of petulance and pettiness, liable to stumble into grouchiness and snarling, even with the person we need most and love completely. Jacob and Rachel enjoy their moments in the sun, but they soon also have to discover the hard work, the willpower, the need to say sorry that lies at the core of a relationship that is real as well as delicious. I remember smiling when I got the email announcing that my former assistant to the minister, Sherrod Eddington, and his wife had a little baby, a girl. I remember thinking, now you'll know what it's like, reality. Because, you see, we once had a bit of a discussion about the effect of love and family on a person. I was saying how it seemed to me that people who have children tend to be a bit more tolerant of children than those who haven't had to deal with them themselves much. You see it on trains and buses and planes. Those who brought up kids smile a knowing, thank goodness it's not me sort of smile, as some poor mother tries to amuse a kid for the 4-hour journey. Now then, Quentin, you just eat your pickle sandwich and read your book. We'll only be another 3¾ hours till we get to Granny's. Well, those who've never had to do it, humph and grump a bit, show little tolerance, pesky children, bah humbug. Old Sherrod got a bit uptight about this discussion. This was in his bachelor boy days, and he was a tiny bit annoyed at the implication that because love and marriage and family forced you, like it or not, to be less self-absorbed, that therefore, as he saw it, I was suggesting that people used only to thinking about their own needs and making their own timetables were somehow, well, more selfish than those used to making adjustments around the needs of others. I wonder what he'd make of that discussion now, as he emerged from his bed at 3 a.m. to feed little Courtney, or as he struggles with all the kit and caboodle that you need these days to take a kid to see Granny in the car, or as he's dragged away from his book to read 1 to 10 and down again for the 4,000,000th time. Self-absorbed? Not so much. But actually, I was wrong and he was right. I was wrong and he was right. He was right to complain to this extent, that the call to love is not confined to those who get married. And there are plenty of people who have no marriage partner, but who know all about the hard sacrifices that loving demands. They may be involved in work that draws their heart towards people in need, children in trouble. who need relationships of respect and response. Or they may be caring for an elderly relative or a neighbour, and they don't need any stupid married person like me teaching them about the price of real loving. Whether it's a teacher who takes their pupils seriously as people, a caring aunt or uncle, a generous-hearted friend, a devoted nun committed to the Christ she loves and the community she serves, a priest exhausting himself in caring. There is no shortage of context in which we can investigate the extent and the implications of loving and feel the stresses of it playing upon our life as it places its demands on our programme, our timetable. And all of this gives a huge insight into the nature of the divine love for us that pays the price, feels the pain, takes the risk. Because this is real loving that God engages in with us, towards us. There's no immunity for him from the potential hazard, the real pain that comes with the experience. The sometimes shocking language the Bible uses leaves us in no doubt as to the heart-to-heart connection God seeks and the love he feels for us and for his people. When Israel goes after false gods, this is not described as some kind of broken rule, but as a love dereliction, a betrayal of the heart and a deep wound to the feelings of God. Israel is described as the tarnished bride who commits adultery and brings shame and hurt to God. With all the passion and beauty of a love poem, the Bible describes the grief of God and the sense of betrayal, shock and hurt he experiences. So this is not some kind of neutral, abstract context in which he operates, but a place of raw emotion, fragile heart sensibilities. When we turn away from God, this is no intellectual event happening in the safe world of ideas. It's about broken hearts, shattered dreams, feelings numbed by the shock of a dreadful dereliction. So that when forgiveness comes, it's no easy, meaningless, cold compress to a fevered brow, costing nothing, requiring little of God. It is heart-to-heart forgiveness, the real kind, wrenched out of the pain of bitter-tasting betrayals. Love hurts God. Our God dares to be vulnerable. And because his is a covenant of love, the kind of unconditional love that underpins our understanding of marriage, for better, for worse, in sickness and in health, for richer, for poorer, it keeps holding on, seeking reconciliation, never giving up, faithful and enduring in its commitment to us. A love that is eternal and stays with us through the now and into the then. We are beings for beyond this human experience, and the love that pours out towards us lasts way beyond the shadows and welcomes us into glory. It's as if whatever experience we have of being loved here and now, or loving here and now in human terms, is a kind of signpost, a clue as to the nature of the love in which we live and move and have our being. This is what it means to be made in the image of God. That we are lovers as he is a lover. We are relationship grounded just as he seeks to find us in relationship. We can be wounded just as he can be wounded. Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed to him but a few days because of the love he had for her. Jacob and Rachel, one of the great love stories of the Bible. God and us, the greatest love story of them all. Where do I begin to tell the story of how great a love can be?